all across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Real information. Good conversation. Unabashedly Wisconsin. Here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense for this Friday.
No.
What we need there, if we ever do that again, is the sound effect of a record needle just scratching right across it, scratching a trench into the record. But it is Friday, just the same, January 27th.
If I could figure that out, I would.
That's poor Erin Zomers, who subjected us to that. What was her name?
Rebecca Black.
Something. Rebecca Black. Okay. I'm still waiting for the follow-up hit.
Like, I think there is. I think we got Saturday, and it was more mediocre than awful because they decided to put a little bit of money behind it.
Oh, no, no. Okay, well, now we have something else to search for. It is a beautiful day on Lake Wissota, a little bit of light snow here and there, and a wind out of the south. That's going to change really quick around noontime. The front is going to finish coming through, bringing in some Arctic air. We're going to see temperatures plunge during the afternoon as the wind comes out of the northwest, and we are going to be below zero for lows up here on Lake Wissota for the next 6 nights. Obviously, I'll adjust that depending on where you are in the state, and your local forecast gets played on these Civic Media stations during the commercial breaks here. Coming up this morning, who's asking for a 30% sales tax? Because the whole debt ceiling debate, it's a farce. It's an imaginary concept. And yet congressional Republicans are threatening to tank the U.S. economy over it. So what's their great idea to fund essential services? How about a 30% national sales tax? We'll talk to Courier Newsroom national correspondent Kiev Akil for that and more of this week's national political headlines. Then later, we'll talk about how House Republicans have created a new committee to investigate what they call the weaponization of the federal government, which simply enables them to harass and undercut the people in law enforcement who helped the country learn more about the effort to overturn an election and launch a violent attack on the U.S. Capitol. There's another new committee that aims to undermine U.S. relations with China. So from Joseph McCarthy to Mike McCarthy, and now throw in Ron Johnson and Mike Gallagher, we see that right now Wisconsin is partially at the front lines of actual government weaponization. And on top of that, we have just learned that another Republican-led investigation has come to an end at the national level, the so-called Durham investigation, which was meant to investigate the people who investigated Russian collusion with the Trump campaign in 2016, only to find out that that Republican-led investigation went nowhere because, of course, it was based on nothing. But the similarities between the Durham investigation and the Gableman investigation in Wisconsin are striking. And again, a reminder of what happens when people in powerful positions decide to abuse their power rather than work for you. We will talk to Mark Jacob, a former editor at the Chicago Tribune and Sun-Times. We'll talk to Courier Newsroom political editorial director Carolyn Fiddler. We will get a sports update with Dan Schumacher from UW-Eau Claire, talking about what's happening in the WIAC, the WIAC, Wisconsin Intercollegiate Athletic Conference, and other things that are going on. Kind of a quiet day sports-wise. Yesterday, we have the Bucks are playing tonight. Let me get down to that. They're in Indiana tonight. And then the Badgers will host Illinois on Saturday. The Badgers have lost 5 of their last 6. That would be the men's basketball team. Let's see. We also are going to talk about the Jennifer Doro family story that was in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel yesterday.
That one's a big yikes.
It's a big yikes, but I think unlike maybe other programs, other hosts, other whatever have you, I understand that I am probably going to come off sounding like the old school journalism professor who says, well, it sounds like you have the makings of a story here, but I don't know if it's a story yet. And, you know, maybe, spoiler alert, there are bigger factors to consider when determining whether Judge Jennifer Doro of Waukesha County is the right choice for state Supreme Court. So we're basically going to think out loud about what do you do with a story like this? What do you know? What do you not know? Does that impede your decision somehow to print the story versus the calendar? Because the voters should get to know whatever they can know. But in doing so, we also have to be very clear about what we don't know. And then, you know, trust the voters to take it from there. It's not an easy story. It's not an easy, the foundation of it is not an easy story. It involves the drug overdose death of a UWM student. It involves, you know, police investigations and the length of them and the factors that might make a police investigation longer, especially when you're talking about a judge's son being in the midst of all of that. So there are a lot of things to consider before anybody should jump to conclusions. And again, maybe come up with other factors as well to base your vote on state Supreme Court. That primary, again, is February 21st for the April 4th general election. And on that February 21st primary, it's the top two of the four candidates who move on. Coincidentally, it's two conservative candidates, including Judge Doro, and two liberal candidates. And there's no guarantee who comes out of there. If it's the two conservatives, if they're the top two vote getters in February, then there is not going to be a choice for a progressive candidate to take that seat on the state Supreme Court in April. So I can't emphasize enough a very important primary for folks to vote in coming up on February 21st. If you want to reach us, 844-967-2789 or radio at upnorthnewswi.com. More after this. You're Up North. Just published over at upnorthnewswi.com an article from Christina Laurie on how Wisconsin's elections in February and April could impact your life for the next 10 years, because that's how long a winning candidate in April can serve as justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It can affect voting rights. It can affect your health care rights, your reproductive health care rights. You'll want to take a look at that by Christina Laurie at upnorthnewswi.com. Also on there, they posted a question of the week earlier this week about book banning and asked the question, what's the best banned book you've ever read? And people have responded with things like, you know, The Catcher in the Rye and Catch 22 and Between the World and Me. So if you'd like to get in on that conversation, you can either go to that post on the Up North News social media feed or simply give us a shout and let us know about banned books that you have read. And the question I really want to know is, does anybody think a book ban does any good? Or does it just simply serve as, you know, free advertising, you know, because now you've made something illicit, you've made it more desirable. So if somebody has an instance where banning a book in, and I'm talking like from high school and public libraries, you know, sheltering kids from certain adult information, that's more of a gray area, because what is a gray area to some in terms of the information we give to children, others see as essential information that can help inform them about their health and about choices and ethics and things like that. But I'm going to turn now to the decision to run a story yesterday in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And if you are a close follower of the news, you'll understand why there was so much chatter in newsrooms across the state yesterday, I would dare say, about the story involving conservative state Supreme Court candidate Jennifer Doro. If you don't follow the news closely, you'll understand why the story hasn't received a lot of attention. And yet the story cannot be completely dismissed either. This is not one of those times where I envy editors who have to decide whether to commit to a story if it's got a lot of speculation that remains unconfirmed, but you might not ever get that confirmation because the story involves someone in a position of power. So at some point, you share what you have and you get ready to take your lumps if it turns out you were duped by any anonymous sources. So let's get into it. The story is not exactly about Waukesha County Judge Jennifer Doro, a candidate for state Supreme Court, but about her 19-year-old son. and whether A, he was helping people obtain certain drugs, B, if so, whether that includes a UW Milwaukee student who died in November 2021 from a fentanyl overdose, C, can it be determined that the fentanyl came from Doro's son versus somebody else, and D, while Doro's son awaits the results of a police investigation, are Judge Doro and her husband paying for his attorney, and should her son be more forthcoming about either his role or what he knows about others who sell opioids and other substances in the UWM area? Now, this is only coming up now and has become a story by Journal Sentinel columnist Dan Bice, because the father of the UWM student who died recently confronted Judge Doro at a campaign event. Doro declined to talk to him since the police investigation is still open. But the victim's father is frustrated that Milwaukee police have said so little in the 14 months since his son died. That's understandable. For him and for his family, this is all taking a very long time. And this is where we get into the really uncomfortable part, where there's speculation, having to ask questions that don't have clear answers yet. Is it taking a long time for police in Milwaukee and around UWM because police are overwhelmed and cases normally take this long? Is it taking a long time because Doro's son and or other people are refusing to talk to police, which, by the way, is their right? The two UWM students who talked to Dan Bice in his story don't go on the record with their names, I don't believe, and that's understandable. And much as this is also uncomfortable to say, could it be things are taking so long because of Doro's status as a judge's son? And that's where I kind of put my own personal disclaimers into this. While I have been pretty clear that I am not likely to vote for Judge Doro in the Supreme Court election, I also really don't know that I would greenlight this story to run either. It's the same discomfort I felt over a Dan Bice story a few weeks ago about one of the other Supreme Court candidates, a progressive, and whether serious allegations made a decade ago against Everett Mitchell, who's now a Dane County judge, were they true? Were they just part of a very messy divorce? Were they a little bit of both? He and his ex-wife released a statement saying they've moved on and so should the rest of us. So both of these stories lead people to assume the worst case scenarios without ironclad proof, the kind that every editor would really like to see. But the calendar is not on the side of an exhaustive investigation. The primary is in 25 days. The worst case scenario hinted at in the Bice story is that Judge Doro was aware her son was engaged in conduct that could harm others. And yes, Judge Doro's son is an adult, and he is not the one who's the candidate. But if Judge Doro, her son, or Milwaukee area police can't shed more light on the matter, and if the worst scenario turns out to be the case, but isn't known until after Judge Doro is elected to the state Supreme Court, how will people feel knowing that a reporter had the story but sat on it because the few people who would talk wouldn't talk on the record? Now, I come at this as both a journalist and a past candidate for office, and the thing I can say with the utmost certainty is that Jennifer Doro can be judged by voters on plenty of other issues. If someone is likely to support her on the issues, for example, her support of scrapping women's abortion rights, those folks will have to decide if she and her son have done things or not done things that make them feel less comfortable about voting for her, despite agreeing with her on the issues. For me, this is an up-close and personal look at just one tragedy, one drop in an ocean of tragedy over this nation's epidemic of drug deaths and abuse and the consequences felt by others around them because of opioids, because of fentanyl, because of meth, because of counterfeit pills that people think were Percocet, but actually turned out to be laced with synthetic chemicals that killed them with just one pill. Ironically, Judge Doro's husband was the Deputy Assistant Secretary at the Department of Homeland Security under President Trump. Judge Duro's husband has been at drug busts on the Mexican border. He is aware of what's coming in from Mexico. He is aware of what's coming in from China. He is aware of what's being done within our own borders. And he knows that taking just one of those counterfeit pills can kill and has killed thousands upon thousands of Americans, including many the same age as his son. There is no easy answer to any of this. And anyone acting like they have an easy answer to our fentanyl crisis, our opioid crisis, is a fool. And trust me, we have some real fools representing us these days in certain offices who think that there is a very clean answer to this crisis. Build a wall is not one of those easy answers. Here's what we need right now. Honesty. We need honesty about what it will take to attack this drug crisis. We need more honesty about our addictions. We need more honesty about the roles we play that feed into someone's addictions or bad behaviors. And we need honesty about our shortcomings in preventing people we know from harming others. And we can't make any progress on this crisis with lies, with silence, with partisan politics. It's going to take all of us working together. And honestly, that's a tall order. But we have to keep trying to do a little better because this isn't about one political race. This is about life and death. So we'll continue to follow this story. We will look for any further comments, any further information. But the takeaway from a Supreme Court race standpoint is there are plenty of other factors on which you can decide whether to support Judge Doro or former Justice Dan Kelly, one of the two conservatives, or Dane County Judge Everett Mitchell, one of the progressives, or Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz, another one of the progressives that are running. And as I've said before, the primary is February 21st, and only the top two advance. Could be the two conservatives, could be the two progressives, could be one of each. It all depends on who shows up on February 21st. And if you have not, as I mentioned yesterday, I have just sent out for my absentee ballot the way that I do all the time. You go to myvote.wi.gov, and in just a few clicks, you can have an absentee ballot mailed to you. All right. I hear some people saying, wait, didn't I just hear that some people use the MyVote website to, you know, falsely obtain somebody else's ballot? Yeah. And they got caught and they're in trouble because you shouldn't do that. Just because the possibility is there to put in somebody else's information and get a ballot doesn't mean you should do it. Just like just because you have deep pockets in your overcoat doesn't mean you should shoplift when you walk through the store. That's not the store's fault. That's yours. So the MyVote website is very convenient and will continue to be so long as we can continue to make clear that if you use it wrong, you're gonna face the consequences for it. So go there, get your absentee ballot. There is also a selection as you work through the process. It'll say, which ballots do you want sent to you? Just for the February 21st primary, for February 21st, as well as April 4th, or the whole year? They do it on a calendar year basis. And I don't know what, if any, other elections will come up, but they're out there. Jake is on the phone now and wants to talk a bit about the Doro story for us. Jake, we got just over a minute left. Good morning. Thanks for calling in.
I just like to point out the fact that this story would have been covered very differently had the drug dealing son of Jennifer Doro been Black and African American. Of course, you know, every paper in the state would have already picked up the story on the front page, but instead they're attacking the Milwaukee paper for, you know, putting out a story that the people need to know before they vote, not after they vote. I think we know from the George Santos story that it's better the voters know before the election instead of after the election what these candidates and their families are up to. And dealing drugs that cause the death of a young college student, yeah, that's an issue that needs to be discussed.
Jake, thank you very much. That you raise a very good point that I did not venture into about whether, again, Judge Doro is a white conservative suburban mom. What if the son had been you know, the son of a progressive candidate, you would see right-wing media falling all over themselves for this. And what if the son had been Black, any other minority? Let's say he had been of Mexican descent or Chinese descent. Oh, I don't think there are enough trees for all the paper from the news releases that would come out from certain politicians in Wisconsin to fire up about this. And so they're the ones right now screaming that the Journal Sentinel shouldn't have run this story at all, that it's all part of a liberal conspiracy. But again, as I explained, each story has to be judged on its own unique circumstances. Courier Newsroom national correspondent Kia Vakil is up next. You're up north.
Follow Up North News with our daily newsletter. Go to our website, upnorthnewswi.com, and click newsletter on the top banner. Once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
Welcome back to Up North News Radio, and we're joined, as we are each week, by Kia Vakil, Courier Newsroom national correspondent, joins us from the West Coast. Kia, good to have you here. Hi.
Hi, Pat. Good to be back.
You've worked on so many different stories for Courier Newsroom, for Up North News, and the other state-based outlets, and we try to review, you know, current events as we can, but I do want to start with a date that happened a few days back, marking the midpoint of Joe Biden's term in office, this first term, assuming he runs for re-election here. And we've said generally it's been a pretty successful 2 years in terms of legislative achievements and what's been done with the economy and whatnot. And you actually go so far as to spell it out in an article you can find over on the Up North News website.
Yeah. So, the Biden administration and the Democratic Congress over the last 2 years passed a whole bunch of legislation when you total it all up and look at it in its entirety is pretty remarkable. And, you know, it's not even really close. It is the most impactful legislation passed by a Democrat since the LBJ era, which is far before I was born. obviously, the Clinton presidency and former President Obama, they did pass legislation as well. But the totality of what Biden has been able to get done and the sort of the record-breaking nature of the investments in mental health and climate and manufacturing and infrastructure, are just things that have not been done in quite a while.
And it, you know, the economy is making that rebound off of its, pandemic recession lows. And this week, Governor Tony Evers, in his State of the State remarks, talked about how well the economy has rebounded. And so you make these targeted investments. And the Republican legislators were almost in this alternate universe where none of these good things have happened, to the point that now Republicans also control the House of Representatives in Washington. And it seems a little odd, but it sounds like their answer to economic momentum is to slap, what is it, a 30% sales tax on everything? It obviously, it's not going to happen, but to even propose that out loud strikes me as odd.
Yeah, it's pretty extreme. You know, it's what's called this fair tax proposal, which is a really comical name for something that would be extremely unfair. Effectively, it'd be a 30% sales tax on everything from groceries to gas to movie tickets to any product you buy or item you buy. The Republicans who support this argue, oh, well, we would be eliminating the federal income tax and we'd be abolishing the IRS. So, you know, it's, you know, you would save on income taxes, which, you know, that might be true. But the people who would actually really save a ton of money on this are billionaires and millionaires who don't need more money. And, you know, the people who are earning 30, 40, 50 grand a year in Wisconsin, in rural communities across the country, in big cities where the cost of living is skyrocketed, they'd be paying 30% tax for daily items. And so it's an insane idea. It's not going to become a law because there aren't enough Republicans who are that extreme yet, and Democrats control the Senate. But it tells you where Republicans are at.
To even put something out like that, much again, like Republicans in Madison are doing with, you know, putting out a flat tax proposal when most folks recognize what a giveaway this is. And in terms of abolishing the IRS, I mean, one of the talking points that they had throughout the campaign was that Joe Biden is unleashing 87,000 IRS agents to come after you, middle-class taxpayer, when I think actually right now, as tax season is picking up, they're able to get the word out about what the extra help for the IRS really means, the extra customer service, the extra resources, not to mention the extra enforcement to go after tax cheats who have 7- and 8-figure incomes.
Yeah. Just for context, I'll share a personal story. Last year, I had to get in touch with the IRS to deal with something related to a family member who passed away. And I spent weeks trying to reach someone on the phone. Could not. Weeks and weeks. Eventually, I literally just found different addresses and sent multiple pieces of mail to different addresses affiliated with the IRS, hoping one of them would get it and then respond. And they did. But in 2022 and 2023, that is an absurd way to do business. And that's because the IRS has been defunded for over a decade, primarily by Republicans. And so, you know, the money that is going to the agency through the Inflation Reduction Act is going to help them, yes, go after tax cheats, you know, people who dodge taxes and use loopholes, but also to hire people to answer the phones that, you know, no one is answering right now or was answering a year ago. I believe I saw earlier this week they've already staffed up 5,000 customer service representatives. That's huge. That's going to make life a lot easier for people like me, for ordinary Americans who have to call with a question because taxes are confusing. They can be difficult. So having someone on the other end of that line is huge.
It provides that help for largely middle-class families, much in the same way the Biden administration has been talking about forgiving student loan debt to a degree. And while that has been a bit of a hot potato involving court cases and such, at least the Biden administration continues to go forward with saying, once this is happening, here's how a new repayment plan would work, for example.
Yes. A couple of weeks back, they rolled out, the Education Department rolled out the details of a plan that Biden had announced last fall, which is basically reforming the income-driven repayment plans, which, you know, basically cap your payment at a percentage of what you make. This is for, you know, low income working class people who can't afford to pay $400 or $500 a month on their student loans, because a lot of these loans have high interest rates. So the new plan effectively cuts in half what percentage of income they'd have to pay, which is basically, it's called discretionary income, which is after rent and needs. And so for millions of Americans, this will zero out their monthly payments. And for a lot of others, it'll cut it in half. So this is basically, you know, it doesn't solve the problem of the spiraling cost of college education. And that's a whole other problem that does need to be addressed. But this ensures that current and future borrowers, you know, who maybe are taking out loans that are, you know, predatory or onerous or just can't find a job that pays them fair value, aren't stuck paying, you know, an insane amount in monthly student loan payments. So it mostly helps low income people.
And it helps people who did take on a debt and have played by the rules and now through a process are having some, and in some cases, all of that student loan forgiven. That's one way to handle a debt load. Then you have the way that some Republicans in Congress want to handle the debt ceiling, which is not spending new money. It's paying the bills that you've already racked up. And there hasn't been a lot of news on that this past week, but that just goes to say Republicans are still looking to force the issue to still play chicken without saying what it is they would want to cut in the budget rather than, you know, live up to their obligations when it comes to the debt ceiling.
Yeah, and that's because the only place is there's nothing they can point to and say they would cut that won't cause backlash. You know, they've said Social Security and Medicare. They may try to cut it, but you're going to see a whole lot of seniors get really pissed off this year, and seniors vote. So, you know, that's one thing. The area of spending that the government spends an enormous amount on is defense. You know, that there's a debate to be had about whether there should be defense spending cut, but Republicans aren't going to have that debate. They're not going to allow anyone to touch defense spending, in most Republicans. So that really leaves very few areas to cut from. And that's, you know, that sort of comes back to the beginning of what we talked about last week. They have no plan. It's just they want to force spending cuts because they want to force tax cuts for the rich. They don't particularly seem to care. At least the most, you know, extreme January 6th MAGA Republicans don't seem to really care about the economy collapsing. And I think that's because, you know, for more than a decade now, they have no agenda other than opposing Democratic policies. They have no agenda other than ginning up fear and outrage and, you know, pushing the economy backwards to win elections. And that's the only move they have, because otherwise, if the economy stays reasonably strong, which it has been, you know, what is their case in 2024?
There is such a sense of deja vu that everything you just said about national Republicans, we've been talking about this week, about Wisconsin legislative Republicans, the lack of a plan, just oppose everything and just fearmonger, which takes us to our next topic, which is immigration, which for a generation, we've known that if you can get people together, come up with a bipartisan immigration reform plan, increase the amount of legal immigration in this country, you will take care of so many labor workforce issues, you'll take care of taxation and budget issues. And yet, again, there is this minority, but still a core, not a small core, of the Republican Party that not only will oppose anything, but their newest development goes way beyond immigration and gets us into asylum. And again, you can't believe it's even being proposed.
Yeah. And so this is a bill that is from a Texas Republican named Chip Roy, who is as pretty conservative and, you know, arguably as extreme as it gets. You know, there's a lot of competition for that title. Basically, the short version is it would give the Homeland Security Secretary a lot of power to essentially prevent any, you know, undocumented migrant from coming into the country. And essentially what it could wind up doing is banning people fleeing violence and persecution and almost certain death in certain, you know, Central American and South American countries. You know, asylum is a thing that exists to help people survive. It's to help refugees. It's to help people, you know, fleeing from countries where, you know, their families would be slaughtered. And the U.S. is supposed to be a country that welcomes people like that, that is, you know, offers them a chance. We are a country of immigrants. You know, we haven't always treated them well, often haven't actually. But, you know, in theory, asylum is something that both sides agree on. It's the sort of, you know, the third rail. You don't really touch asylum because it's such a human rights thing. But this bill would effectively ban asylum. And so you even see a few Republicans speaking out against it.
The last question, the last topic area we don't have a lot of time for. So rather than get into the intricacies of what was in President Biden's garage or Mike Pence's home, I think it needs to be asked of all of us. So I'll start with you, Kia. Do you currently have classified documents in your place? Have you looked, basically? I think we all have to look.
I do not. I have not looked, but I am fairly certain that I do not have any classified documents. I've never served in a government role or in a public service role. But yeah, I think it probably is good for every previous office holder to look, because seemingly everyone and their mother took documents. And, you know, there's degrees of how bad that is. You know, if it's something you just did, you know, accidentally, that's a different story from, you know, if you intentionally took them and covered them up. But yeah, it's, you know, everyone should probably double check.
Well, anybody in those positions, because again, and as I said on the program earlier this week, by and large, we're talking about a process problem, the process of packing things up or of handling documents. That's a process problem, as opposed to what's happening at Mar-a-Lago, which could be better described as a heist. And to both sides, that is just not right. Kia Vakil, Courier Newsroom National Correspondent, thanks so much again for your time. Enjoy your weekend.
Thank you. Good to be back. Have a good one, Pat.
Our thanks again to Kia for being part of that, part of our week's look at the headlines. I wanted to call attention before we turn toward this day in history and music history to a story written in Wisconsin Watch, wisconsinwatch.org, by Mario Caran, a wonderful follow-up on what's happened in Keel, over in East Central Wisconsin, a school district that was rocked by threats of violence. There was transgender bullying. There were bomb threats. And most of this, the result of a right-wing takeover of the school board there. And of course, that was based in a war against wokeness, which again is, don't be a racist, don't discriminate against people based on their gender and things like that. And while they won the school board elections, they tried to go a bit too far and tried to push out a superintendent who, actually embraced teaching correct views of science and history and whatnot. And the people liked that superintendent. They rose up, and a couple of those conservatives are no longer on the school board, and Keele feels like it's getting its identity back. So in Wisconsin Watch, I would highly recommend looking at that. We'll have Carolyn Fiddler, Courier Newsroom Political Editorial Director, coming up as we look at this day in history and more headlines. You're up north. That I found the key to you. It was on this day, January 27th, 1998, the Dixie Chicks, now the Chicks, released their major label debut, Wide Open Spaces, the trio's first album with lead singer Natalie Maines. And still, an instant classic and probably a perpetual favorite of mine, Carolyn Fiddler. How are you?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Good, good. And that song resonates because it's about, a girl leaving her parents and going to live out on her own, to a place out west. And not long after that, one of my daughters did just that and, moved out to Idaho. And there was hardly a dry eye every time that song came on. But still an excellent album. And I got to admit, still kind of makes my blood boil over how their career was upended in 2003. But they seem to be at peace with it. They've moved into family life, parenthood. I think they're working on a project or something. Maybe.
Yeah, they've had albums out. Mm-hmm. Not too long ago, and they seem to have done well in my recollection. I don't follow them super closely, but I applaud their success because I agree they got a really raw deal back in the aughts.
Exactly. Let's see. I got a bunch of birthdays and things to go through. So why don't we, Aaron, play the song that topped the charts on this day in 2001, which would be a little Destiny's Child.
Yes.
Do you remember the movie soundtrack this was on?
Oh, yes. Charlie's Angels.
Yeah, I like that movie. It was
fun.
I didn't like any of the follow-ups, but that first one was just so campy and funny. And I
really leaned into it. Yeah, I agree. Yep.
Let's see. We're not playing a musical selection from Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, even though he was born on this day in 1756.
That's very nice. I love Mozart.
Oh, do you really? I'm sorry. Well, Aaron, don't let me forget. We're playing Mozart next week for the entire segment.
Okay, sounds good.
He's like, no.
As a music student who's had plenty of music theory classes, Mozart is not my favorite. But
Okay. Well, then next week, just to be passive aggressive, he's just going to play Rock Me Amadeus over and over again. Thomas Edison got his patent for the light bulb this day in 1880. Ross Bagdasarian took the stage with the name David Seville and created Alvin and the Chipmunks. He was born on this day in 1919. Wow. And then one more music quiz for you, Carolyn. This is the birthday of G.E. Smith. He would be 71 years old today. Guitarist, songwriter, lead guitarist for what band?
The SNL stage band, right?
Oh, that's where everybody knows him from. But prior to that, he was and still is lead guitarist for Hall & Oates. So all of the Hall & Oates hits, that's him. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. Next little tune comes from Stevie Wonder. This, of course, would be Superstition. It hit number one on this date in 1973. Also on this day in 1973, the Paris Peace Accords officially ended the Vietnam War. On this day in 1980, at the height of the Iran hostage crisis, the U.S. and Canadian governments worked together to help six American diplomats secretly escape the country in a caper later portrayed in a 2012 film. Do you remember the film? Did you see
Argo.
It? Argo. Yep. With John Goodman, Bryan Cranston, and of course, Alan Arkin, who tells a joke about Argo that we can't tell on the radio. But that was the Best Picture Oscar winner that year. Next, let's play a little Camila Cabello, because she was top of the charts this day 5 years ago, celebrating the city where she was born. But as often happens as we get closer to the present day on this day in history stuff, I get to show off my old age. The note here says she went to number one this day in 2018, a little over a year after leaving Fifth Harmony. Today, I learned that Camila Cabello was in Fifth Harmony. Didn't know. Can't say I really
followed. I
don't
think I realized that either.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good. So here we are. All right. And one last one here from this day in 1991. American troops had been fighting the Gulf War for about 10 days. It was Super Bowl Sunday, and Whitney Houston and the Florida Symphony Orchestra gave us this. So people ask, as I sacrilegiously talk over the national anthem here, what was it about it? Not just her voice, of course, but what made it? It was actually a top 20 hit when released as a single. Oh, wow. So I'll read here. Partly inspired by Marvin Gaye's 1983 version at the NBA All-Star Game, which is, again, iconic, Whitney's musical director and an arranger reworked the tune. Now, I don't know music theory. Aaron, feel free to jump in here, but this always catches me when I see it. They changed the harmonic structure of the Star Spangled Banner, a song normally done in 4/4 time, to 3/4 time, and then added a groove in the orchestra's percussion section with multiple chord changes. And I remember at the time people saying that that was, you know, like a travesty. You can't, you know, you have to do it this way. I still think it's brilliant.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't realize that they'd mess with the arrangement like that, but it makes perfect sense because that song, it's very hard to sing, and like, yeah, there's a reason. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We remember her version for sure.
Aaron, from all those music classes, does this version strike a chord? strike a chord with you?
Well, I do have to say that it was actually changed from 3 to 4, not 4 to 3.
Okay. I probably copied that wrong, so that's on me.
That makes more sense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If anything, yeah, like I know 3/4 time. That was this day in music history. We talked to, you know, Kia Vakil a little bit earlier about the debt ceiling fight. Not that much has happened this week, but the fact that there is still the showdown out there is itself news, because it means we're going to have to talk about the scenarios for the foreseeable future. Was there anything that you observed this week that told us that there's any resolution in sight to this, or do we still see something that is going to drag on through the winter and spring probably?
Oh, it's definitely going to drag on. It's going to be, you know, Groundhog Day is not going to be about whether or not we get more winter. It's going to be about how long we have to deal with this fight.
So it leads to this question, because again, Speaker McCarthy has a tenuous hold on that. It took 15 ballots to get there. He can only afford to lose, what, 4 votes? Mm-hmm. He can be a measure can be brought up by, what, a single member, mm-hmm, to hold a vote to kick him out. So then the question becomes, Which gets resolved for which of these things happens first, a debt ceiling resolution or a new Speaker of the House? I mean, Kevin McCarthy is the head of lettuce that they had the camera on during Liz Truss's very brief time as British Prime Minister.
I mean, it all depends on how much he values keeping that job over, you know, the fate of the national and world economy.
Oh, gosh.
And I'm not sure which he thinks is more important, to be honest.
He did say that he's 1,000% confident in his job security.
Well, anytime you're measuring something as 1,000%, I mean, clearly this math whiz should be trusted with the budget of the United States of America. So since we so often shortchange you by having some fun with you with the music, do you want to stick around for the next segment and we'll see what else you're working on these days?
Sure thing.
All right. We would appreciate that. Folks in Wisconsin Rapids, you're leaving us now, and you enjoy your morning show there, and everybody else will hear a little bit of news, get your weather update, and then we'll talk more headlines with Carolyn Fiddler right after this break. You're up north.